parent disabled children shouldn't allow themselves to become pregnant in the first place. The reality, however, is that most people embark on parenthood in optimism, and even those who soberly consider a worst-case scenario cannot adequately predict their response to such a situation until they are in it. Ambivalence exists in all human relationships, including parent-child. Anna Freud maintained that a mother could never satisfy her infant's needs because those are infinite, but that eventually, child and mother outgrow their dependence. Children with MSD have permanent needs far beyond that infinity. In Tornin 2, the British psychoanalyst Rosika Parker complains that in our open, modern society, the extent of maternal ambivalence is a dark secret. Most mothers treat their occasional wish to be rid of their children as if it were the equivalent of murder itself. Parker proposes that mothering requires two impulses, the impulse to hold on and the impulse to push away. To be a successful mother, you must nurture and love your child, but cannot smother and cling to your child. Mothering involves sailing between what Parker calls the Scylla of intrusiveness and the Charybdis of neglect. She proposes that the sentimental idea of perfect synchrony between mother and child can cast a sort of sadness over motherhood, a constant state of mild regret that a delightful oneness seems always out of reach. Perfection is a horizon virtue, and our very approach to it reveals its immutable distance. The dark portion of maternal ambivalence toward typical children is posited as crucial to the child's individuation. But severely disabled children, who will never become independent, will not benefit from their parents' negative feelings, and so their situation demands an impossible state of emotional purity. Asking the parents of severely disabled children to feel less negative emotion than the parents of healthy children is ludicrous. My experience of these parents was that they all felt both love and despair. You cannot decide whether to be ambivalent. All you can decide is what to do with your ambivalence. Most of these parents have chosen to act on one side of the ambivalence they feel, and Julia Hollander chose to act on another side. But I am not persuaded that the ambivalence itself was so different from one of these families to the next. I am enough of a creature of my times to admire most the parents who kept their children and made brave sacrifices for them. I nonetheless esteem Julia Hollander for being honest with herself and for making what all those other families did look like a choice. Chapter 8. Prodigies. Being gifted and being disabled are surprisingly similar. Isolating, mystifying, petrifying. One of the most startling patterns that emerged during my research was that many people come to value abnormalities that are ostensibly undesirable. Equally, ostensibly desirable variances are often daunting. Many prospective parents who dread the idea of a disabled child will long for an accomplished one. Such children may create beauty in the world. They may derive intense pleasure from their achievements. They may stretch their parents' lives into wonderful new alignments. Clever people often have clever sons and daughters. But dazzling brilliance is an aberration, as horizontal an identity as any in this study. Despite the past century's breakthroughs in psychology and neuroscience, prodigiousness and genius are as little understood as autism. Like parents of children who are severely challenged, parents of exceptionally talented children are custodians of children beyond their comprehension. A prodigy is able to function at an advanced adult level in some domain before the age of 12. I've used the word expansively to include anyone who develops a profound innate gift at an early age, even if he does so more gradually or less publicly than classic prodigies. Prodigy derives from the Latin prodigium, a monster that violates the natural order. These people have differences so evident as to resemble a birth defect. The anxiety of abnormality goes beyond etymology. Few people wish to be identified as prodigies, especially given the correlation between prodigiousness and burnout, prodigiousness and freakishness. Prodigies are, in the eyes of many prodigies, pathetic, uncanny weirdos, with little chance of lifetime social or professional success, their performances more party tricks than art. The designation prodigy usually reflects timing, while genius reflects the ability to add something of value to human consciousness. Many people have genius without precocity, or prodigiousness without brilliance. The French poet Raymond Radiguet said, "Child prodigies exist just as there are extraordinary men, but they are rarely the same." Here, however, I've been engaged by a continuum that embraces both phenomena and have allowed the words considerable overlap. The subjects of this chapter indicate how the emergence of disproportionate ability at any stage may alter family dynamics, much as the emergence of schizophrenia or disability will do at any stage. Premature attainment and ultimate merit are, however, very different identities. Like a disability, prodigiousness compels parents to redesign their lives around the special needs of their child. Once more, experts must be called in. Once more, their primary strategies for dealing with the aberrance often undermine parental power. A child's prodigiousness requires his parents to seek out a new community of people with similar experience. They soon face the mainstreaming dilemma and must decide whether to place their children with intellectual peers too old to befriend them or with age peers who will be bewildered and alienated by their achievements. Brilliance can be as much of an impediment to intimacy as any developmental anomaly, and the health and happiness of families of prodigies do not outstrip those of others in this book. Prodigiousness manifests most often in athletics, mathematics, chess, and music. I have focused on musical prodigies here because my ability to understand music exceeds my comprehension of sports, math, or chess. A musical prodigy's development hinges on parental collaboration. Without that support, the child would never gain access to an instrument or the training that even the most devout genius requires. As David Henry Feldman and Lynn T. Goldsmith, scholars in the field, have said, a prodigy is a group enterprise. A parent is the progenitor of much of a child's behavior, telling that child repeatedly who he has been, is, and could be, reconciling accomplishment and innocence. In constructing this narrative, parents often confuse the anomaly of developing fast with the objective of developing profoundly. There is no clear delineation between supporting and pressuring a child, between believing in your child and forcing your child to conform to what you imagine for him. You can damage prodigies by nurturing their talent at the expense of personal growth, or by cultivating general development at the expense of the special skill that might have given them the deepest fulfillment. You can make them feel that your love is contingent on their dazzling success, or that you don't care about their talent. Prodigies invite a sacrifice of the present to the putative future. If society's expectations for most children with profound differences are too low, expectations for prodigies are often perilously high. Musicality does not appear to convey an evolutionary advantage. Yet every human society has music. The archaeologist Stephen Mithen, in The Singing Neanderthals, argues that music plays a crucial role in cognitive development. Recent work on infant-directed speech, the exaggerated tonalities that almost everyone uses in talking to babies, has shown that infants prefer these melodic enunciations. The scholar John Blacking has said that music is there in the body, waiting to be brought out and developed. Members of one culture can differentiate the joyful and sorrowful music of another culture. This innate capacity for musical discernment notwithstanding, music is shaped by exposure, like any language. We absorb our culture's characteristic harmonic progressions and feel the fulfillment or reversal of learned musical expectations. The sociologist Robert Garfias contends that music and spoken language are a single system acquired in early infancy, and that music may be our primary means of sustaining a process of socialization. Just as deaf children will begin to communicate with physical gestures, musical prodigies may use musical tones to convey information from the outset. For them, music is speech itself. It is said that Handel sang before he talked. The pianist Arthur Rubinstein would sing a mazurka when he wanted cake. John Slobra, a music psychologist who studies why we respond emotionally to patterns of notes and rhythms, wrote, "Musical idioms are not languages and do not have referential meaning in the way that languages such as English do. They do, however, have complex, multi-leveled structural features which resemble syntax or grammar. This means that, in the sense proposed by the linguist Noam Chomsky, a deep structure of music in the brain can be vitalized by exposure to sounds." Leon Botstein, president of Bard College and himself a former prodigy, said, "What makes for a great musician is the emotional gravitation to music as an alternative form of linguistic communication." As with spoken and signed language, there must be not only a means to express, but also people to receive, respond, and encourage, which is why parental involvement is crucial to the emergence of this faculty. That music is a first language does not guarantee brilliant use of that language, however, any more than American children's fluency in English makes them all poets. For Evgeny Kissin, called Zhenya by those who know him, music was without question a first language, and one that his parents understood. In the mid-1970s, friends would visit the piano teacher Emilia Kissina in Moscow, and they would hear her young son play the piano. Frustrated at her reluctance to enroll him in a special academy, "They lose their childhood. They struggle so hard in those places," she would say. A friend arranged an appointment with Anna Pavlovna Kantor of the famed Niesen School in 1976 when Zhenya was 5. Kantor, too, was initially reluctant. "It was September," she recalled. "I said the exams were long over." "When you meet the little boy," this friend replied, "you will understand that nothing is over." 1 week after, this mother came with her son, with curls all over his head like an angel. He opened his bottomless eyes, and I saw a light in him. Without knowing how to read music or the names of notes, he played everything. I asked him to translate a story into music. I said that we were coming into a dark forest, full of wild animals, very scary, and then step by step, the sun rises, and the birds start singing. He began in the piano's lower register, in a dark and dangerous place, and then, lighter and lighter, the birds awakening, the first rays of the sun, and finally a delightful, almost ecstatic melody, his hands running along the keys. I didn't want to teach him. Such imagination can be very fragile. But his mother said, "Clever and faithful helper, don't worry, He is interested in whatever is new to him. Try. The Kissens lived the life of the Soviet Jewish intelligentsia. Physically uncomfortable, constantly frustrating, the pleasures of the mind partially filling in for ordinary discomforts of the flesh, and ideology's constant intrusions on the spirit. Their assumption was that Zhenya's sister, Alla, would play piano like her mother, while Zhenya would be an engineer like his father, Igor. At 11 months, Zhenya sang an entire Bach fugue that his sister had been practicing. He began to sing everything he heard. It was rather embarrassing to take him out in the streets, Emilia recalled. As it went on, relentless, non-stop, I became frightened by it. At 26 months, Zhenya sat down at the piano and with one finger picked out some of the tunes he had been singing. The next day he did the same. And on the third day he played with both hands, using all his fingers. He would listen to LPs and immediately play back the music. Chopin's ballades he would play with those little hands, and Beethoven sonatas, Liszt's rhapsodies, his mother told me. At 3, he began improvising. He especially liked to make musical portraits of people. I would make the rest of the family guess whom I was playing, he recalled. Cantor taught him in the Russian tradition that the imagination and spirit of the performer should be equal to that of the composer. Anna Pavlovna's greatest triumph, Emilia explained, is that she preserved his gift. She knew how to supplement what was there, never replace it. When I asked Zhenya how he had managed to avoid the burnout of so many Wunderkinder, he said, simply this, I was brought up well. By the time he was 7, Zhenya had begun to write down his compositions. He played as though it were a necessary emancipation. When I would return from school, I would, without taking my coat off, go to the piano and play, he said. I made my mother understand that this was just what I needed. Zhenya used to make lists for Anna Pavlovna of the things he wanted to learn. If I was asking for a difficult piece, I would put in brackets. Lenin said, difficult doesn't mean impossible. He played his first solo recital in May of 1983, at 11. I had such a feeling of relief, he recalled. During intermission, I was impatient to return to the stage. After the concert, the wife of someone high up in the composer's union congratulated teacher and pupil and promised an invitation to perform. This was a gateway to fame and comfort in the Soviet period of deprivation. Cantor, however, was uneasy. He is still very young, she replied. He shouldn't be overexposed. A stranger standing nearby interrupted and identified himself as a doctor. When I saw in what a state of enthusiasm the boy returned to the stage for his encores, I realized it would be even more dangerous for him to become so overexcited inside without release, he said. He needs to perform. Zhenya played at the Union's House of Composers a month later. When the preeminent conductor Daniel Barenboim came to Moscow the following January, he heard Zhenya play and arranged an invitation to Carnegie Hall. Musical performance enjoyed a special status among the arts in the Soviet Union because interpretive acts were less ideologically suspect than creative ones. But the government sought to keep its geniuses, so neither Zhenya nor his teacher was told about Carnegie Hall. A few months later, Zhenya played both of Chopin's piano concertos in Moscow. Afterward, Zhenya's parents told him that they had a surprise, a visit to a town in the country. Years later, he learned that they had arranged the trip because they knew what a sensation the concert would create, and they didn't want him exposed to so much praise. As Zhenya began to tour, he received private tutoring in the usual subjects of history, literature, mathematics, dialectical materialism, Leninism, military science, and so on. He had never been very connected to other people his age, and the escape from ordinary schooling was a relief. In 1985, he left the USSR for the first time to play at a gala in East Berlin for leader Erich Honecker. There were some circus performers. Then I played the Schumann Liszt Widmung and the Chopin E minor waltz, and then a magician did tricks, he recalled. 2 years later, with travel restrictions easing under the new policy of Glasnost, Zhenya played for the renowned conductor Herbert von Karajan, who pointed at him and said through tears, "Genius." Unlike many prodigies, he does not mourn his childhood. "Sometimes I regret that the course of my life was set so early," he told me. "There was never any way to resist it. But even if my career had begun later, music would always have been the only thing that was important to me." In 1990, at 19, he made his Carnegie Hall debut to astonishing reviews. In 1991, the family emigrated to New York. Anna Pavlovna Cantor came with them. Zhenya had been described to me before we first met in 1995 as a moon child, peculiar, closed, incomprehensible. And at that initial encounter, he explained clearly that he had little to say about himself beyond the facts. "He has never much liked talking, or journalists, or the attention many celebrities find flattering. He is indifferent to his success, except insofar as it allows him to play more." Zhenya is too tall and too thin, with a strangely large head, enormous brown eyes, pale skin, and a mop of crazy brown hair in which you could mislay something. The overall effect is slightly gangly, and his bearing combines the tense and the beatific. Watching Zhenya sit down at the piano is like seeing a lamp plugged in. Decorative though it may have seemed, only then does its real use become apparent. You feel less that he is pouring energy into the instrument than that he is receiving energy from it. "I don't know if I would be able to live if I suddenly became unable to play," he said. Zhenya plays as though it were a moral act that could redeem the world. Throughout the 90s, Zhenya was always accompanied on tour by his mother and Cantor. The dynamic between the two women was both intimate and respectful. Neither would critique Zhenya's performance without consulting the other. Upon arriving in any new center, Zhenya would run through his program. Cantor would sit still to assess the performance, while Emilia would wander the hall to check acoustics. Zhenya was never given leeway to become arrogant. "They didn't want me seeing myself as a great prodigy," he said. "But when I deserved it, they always praised me too." While his father and sister disappeared to the shadows, Zhenya stayed with his mother and piano teacher. One critic referred to them as a three-headed beast. "If Zhenya plays the piano with the fluidity with which I talk, he talks with the awkwardness with which I play the piano. His profound intelligence and complex thoughts are indicated but not expressed by conversation. Zhenya has a slight speech impediment, a lingering on explosive consonants that burst forth like popping balloons. His utterances are saturated with pauses. Nothing organic leads from one word to the next. When he was little, Cantor would explain something, then, when he didn't respond, would explain again, more elaborately. Finally, she would say, 'Have you understood?' Zhenya would say, 'Yes, I understood a long time ago.' It had not occurred to him to say so. When he was in his 20s, the concertmaster of an orchestra with which he was to perform noticed his practicing during the break and commented that she could not work without an occasional rest. Zhenya said, "That is why you are not a soloist." He is solicitous to a fault, but this ingenuous frankness pervades his communication. The critic Anne Majette wrote in the Washington Post, "The performance was so compelling precisely because of the awkward poignancy that accompanied the technical mastery." I had been toying with the idea of music as a first language for some time before I put it to Zhenya one day about a year after we met. We were sitting in his apartment on Manhattan's Upper West Side. Our meeting had been impromptu. I wanted to know something about the structure of a Rachmaninoff cadenza. "This one?" asked Zhenya, and played 6 bars. On the tape of our meeting, the emotional transition is more surprising than the shift from speech to music. The notes contain all the feeling absent from the words. I thought of a fish that flips around on the deck of a boat, then slips back into pure grace in the water. A yearning to be understood, the primary beauty of Zhenya's playing, distinguishes this from technical facility. Though he was playing only to indicate passages to which I had alluded, I felt for the first time that we were in full conversation. It was as intimate as a confidence or an embrace. Zhenya told me, "Music conveys what I feel. I don't know how to convey through speech at all. I don't like to speak about the music either. It speaks for itself." Music makes sense of the world for him, which is why it seems to make sense of the world for his audiences. More than a decade after our first meeting, I asked him whether he had fully realized his own insights. Zhenya said simply, "Not yet." Later he added, "When I played as a child, it was simply that I loved music and was just playing the way I felt it. The better and the clearer my ideas become, the more I realize how difficult it is for me to achieve them. In the past, I've been tempted to take up conducting, but now I don't want to, exactly because I realize how difficult it is to play the piano. That's why now I am more nervous before my concerts than I used to be." This is as fair a description as I've ever heard of how a prodigy grows up. For Zhenya Kissin, music is the repository of intimacy. Others deploy it to express what circumstances or temperament forbid them to utter. The pianist Yefim Bronfman, called Fima, a prototype for explosive genius, was born in Tashkent in 1958. His father, Naum Bronfman, had been drafted into the Soviet army and taken prisoner by the Germans. He escaped and managed to walk 600 miles back to Moscow, where he was imprisoned and tortured by Stalin. Fima's mother, Polina, had been a Nazi prisoner in Poland. Naum was a violinist who taught in the Tashkent Conservatory. Polina was a pianist who taught pupils at home. "We always suspected that somebody was listening to our conversations," Fima told me. "So the only way you could express yourself was through the music. That's what made us work so hard at it." Music became a realm of liberty, a medium in which it was possible for the Bronfmans to articulate everything they couldn't say in a bugged apartment. Part of the beauty of Fima's mature performance is that lingering urgency. If some musicians converse in music because their brains are not strongly wired for spoken language, Fima, who has never married and, like Zhenya Kissin, lives with his mother, remains in those original suppressed conversations and produces music with the exigency of having been denied speech for the most important of his early dialogues. Russian music of the 20th century consistently exploited the expressive merits of ambiguity, of being able to say things that a bureaucrat cannot pin down and label subversive. Music can liberate people immured in almost any kind of silence. The origin of genius has been a topic of philosophical debate for at least 2,500 years. Plato believed that genius was bestowed by the gods upon passive human beings. Longinus proposed that it was something a person does, that the genius does not receive divinity, but creates it. John Locke, who, tellingly, had no children, thought that parents could engender genius. He said, "I imagine the minds of children as easily turned this or that way as water itself." This idea from the Age of Reason, the period in which genius took on its current meaning, gave way to a romantic image of ingenuity swathed in mystery. Immanuel Kant said, "If an author owes a product to his genius, he himself does not know how he came by the ideas for it." Arthur Schopenhauer said, "Talent hits a target no one else can hit. Genius hits a target no one else can see." In 1869, Francis Galton's Hereditary Genius announced that genius could not be achieved by anyone not born to it. Lewis M. Terman, a eugenicist and follower of Galton's, developed the Stanford-Binet intelligence test, which measured IQ, to categorize army recruits during World War I. After the armistice, he pressed to have it used on preschool-age children as a predictor of academic success. Because such quantifiable intelligence tests have built-in biases, measurements of low IQ appear to demonstrate the inferiority of undesirable groups. The question of how high IQ correlates to genius has been in debate ever since the tests were introduced. Terman followed a group of about 1,500 children with very high IQs. 70 years later, his critics claimed, they had accomplished no more than their socioeconomic status would have predicted. One child Terman had excluded as not bright enough, William Shockley, had co-invented the transistor and won the Nobel Prize in Physics. Psychometrics were nonetheless championed by the eugenicists. Paul Popenoe, who advocated forced sterilization of the inferior, asserted that no son of an unskilled laborer has ever become an eminent man of science in the United States. Hitler was well versed in the work and ideas of Galton and Popenoe. Indeed, Popenoe enthusiastically collaborated with his Nazi counterparts and defended them until it was no longer advantageous to do so. The Holocaust had a dampening effect on the notion of inherent supremacy, and in 1944, the anthropologist Alfred Kroeber suggested that genius was contextual. Why did 5th-century Athens or the Italian Renaissance or the Song Dynasty produce clusters of genius? Shouldn't it have a fixed population frequency? If genius springs from genetics, a meritocracy is hardly more just than the divine right of kings. It too mythologizes inherent superiority. If genius results from labor, then brilliant people deserve the kudos and wealth they reap. The communist perspective is that everyone can be a genius if he will only work at it. The fascist perspective is that born geniuses are a different species from the rest of humanity. Many people fall short of their potential through lack of discipline, but a visit to a coal mine will amply demonstrate that hard work on its own neither constitutes genius nor guarantees riches. The history of high intelligence is no less political than the history of intellectual disability or of mental illness. Leon Fleischer was born in 1928 in San Francisco, where his immigrant father had become a milliner who made hats for Lucille Ball. Leon's brother was the reluctant recipient of piano lessons, and Leon used to listen. When my brother went out to play ball, I would go to the piano and play as the teacher wanted, Leon recalled. His parents soon switched the lessons to Leon, and before long he was studying with a Russian named Lev Shore, who was the San Francisco prodigy maker. He felt it wasn't a good lesson unless he made me cry, but he would take me out to lunch afterward and feed me lamb chops. In 1937, the conductor of the San Francisco Symphony heard one of Leon's first recitals and decided that the boy should study in Italy with the renowned pianist Arthur Schnabel. Schnabel politely declined. He was not interested in 9-year-old pupils. A few months later, the conductor invited Schnabel to dinner, snuck Leon in, and obliged Schnabel to listen. Schnabel immediately took Leon as a student, on the condition that he give no further concerts. Schnabel understood that Leon's mother wanted merely fame, and that he had to keep the boy focused on music. Leon and his mother went to Como in 1938. Schnabel's lessons were different from anything Leon had known. "The prodigy makers separate technique and music," Leon said. Schnabel maintained that technique is the ability to do what you want. He advocated sitting in a comfortable chair and studying the music before you started to play, not drumming it out before you thought how you'd like it to sound. Schnabel never had more than a half dozen students, and he made each attend the other's lessons. He would do a whole lesson on 12 bars, and we would stagger out like inebriates, Leon recalled, filled not just with information, but with inspiration. Schnabel dealt in transcendence. At the brink of World War II, Italy was hardly the place for a Jewish pupil to study with a Jewish pianist, and before long Schnabel sent Leon back home. Schnabel emigrated to New York soon thereafter, so Leon's father had to take a job in an East Coast factory. "That became a heavy responsibility for a kid to carry around," Leon said, but his mother was singularly determined. "She gave me a choice between being the first Jewish president or a great pianist," he added ruefully. Leon Fleischer made his Carnegie Hall debut in 1944 at 16 and quickly established himself. His career rise was meteoric, and 3 years later Schnabel told him that his studies were over. "I was desolate when he dismissed me," Leon said. "Then I remember hearing on the radio one of his Beethoven sonata recordings and reveling in how extraordinarily beautiful it was. But I wasn't sure that I would have done it in quite that way." Leon had a 20-year blaze of glory before he was struck at 36 with focal dystonia, a neurological condition that causes involuntary muscle contractions, which made it impossible for him to use the third and fourth fingers of his right hand. Focal dystonia is associated with relentless repetition of fine motor skill patterns, despite the onset of pain. Leon's son, the jazz musician Julian Fleischer, explained, "He used his right hand relentlessly because his mother told him to. He used it until it broke." Leon went through a depression. His marriage fell apart. "It took a couple of years of despair before I realized that my connection was to music, not to being a two-handed piano player," he said. He reinvented himself as a conductor, a teacher, and a performer of the limited but pyrotechnic left-hand piano repertoire. Leon's maturity is highly self-aware. You can either perform a piece as though you're in the midst of what's happening, or as a narrator, he said. "You know, once upon a time there was..." That can be more expressive. It frees the listener's imagination. It doesn't dictate, "This is what I feel, therefore you should feel this. A prodigy can't do that, but a fully developed performer can. He described brilliant young students as being like people who want to build a house around a decorative object. I teach them, the bedroom goes here, the kitchen there, and the living room there. You have to have that before you fill it with beautiful things. First is the structure. His son Riley pointed out that this tremendously nuanced way of thinking does not extend to human relations. It's not a question of being nice, but of noticing the minds of the people he loves. But then in the music, it's all there. I wondered whether Leon's dystonia had brought any rewards. This forced me, and so enabled me, to go sideways, to expand my field of, what is the companion word to vision? Origin? Were I given the chance to relive it and not come down with focal dystonia, I'm not sure I would change anything. The dystonia proved what he had learned from Schnabel, that musicianship requires modesty. Schnabel likened the performer to the Alpine mountain guide, Leon said. His aim is to lead you to the top of the mountain so that you can enjoy the view. He isn't the goal. The view is. When Leon was in his mid-70s, Botox relaxed the permanently cramped muscles of his hand, and Rolfing further eased the movement of his soft tissue. He began to perform with both hands again, and his subsequent recordings earned him high honors. The technique isn't what it was, and what's left is the musicality, Julian said. He almost doesn't play notes. He plays the meaning in them. Leon said, I am in no way cured. When I play, a good 80-90% of my concentration and awareness is how to deal with my hand. I've worn away the cartilage between my joints, so bone is rubbing on bone in my fingers. And it's a little bit like the Little Mermaid. She fell in love with a man, and her wish was granted. She became a human. The price was that every step she took was like walking on knives. That's a fairy tale I remember very, very clearly. Musical prodigies are sometimes compared to child actors. But child actors portray children. No one pays to watch a 6-year-old playing Hamlet. No discipline has ever been permanently transformed by a child's revelations. Leon Botstein said, prodigies confirm conventional wisdom. They never change it. Musical performance can quickly be integrated because it is rule-driven, structured, and formal. Profundity comes later. Mozart was the archetypal prodigy, but if he hadn't lived past 25, we'd know nothing of him as a composer. After the English lawyer Daines Barrington examined the 8-year-old Mozart in 1764, he wrote, he had a thorough knowledge of the fundamental principles of composition. He was also a master of modulation, and his transitions from one key to another were excessively natural and judicious. Yet Mozart was also clearly a child. Whilst he was playing to me, a favorite cat came in, upon which he immediately left his harpsichord, nor could he bring him back for a considerable time. He would also sometimes run about the room with a stick between his legs by way of a horse. Every prodigy is a chimera of such mastery and childishness, and the contrast between musical sophistication and personal immaturity can be striking. One prodigy whom I interviewed had switched from the violin to the piano when she was 7. She offered to tell me why if I didn't tell her mother. I wanted to sit down, she said. Most people who receive rigorous early training do not become singular musicians. Juilliard's Veda Kaplinsky, who is perhaps the world's most highly esteemed piano teacher for younger students, explained, "Until the child reaches 18 or 19, you don't know if he'll have the emotional capacity for expression. A mature childhood can be a recipe for an immature adulthood, a principle most publicly borne out by Michael Jackson. A Japanese proverb says that the 10-year-old prodigy becomes a talented 15-year-old on the way to mediocrity at 20. The sprinter unwisely indulges his arrogance against the marathon runner. And likewise, parents who encourage their children's narcissism do them no favors. It is best to accomplish something before becoming famous, because if the fame comes first, it often precludes accomplishment. The manager Charles Hamlin, who has nurtured the careers of many stellar musicians, wearily described the parents who want their children to make Carnegie Hall debuts at 12. "You don't build a career by playing Carnegie Hall," he said. "You build a career, and then Carnegie Hall will invite you to play." Schnabel saw Leon Fleischer as a child with remarkable skills, rather than a set of skills inconveniently attached to a child. But many parents lack the sophistication to make such a distinction. Karen Monroe, a psychiatrist who works with prodigious children, said, "When you have a child whose gift is so overshadowing, it is easy for parents to be distracted and lose track of the child himself." Van Cliburn was among the preeminent prodigies of the 20th century, although he was not catapulted to fame until he was 23, when he won the Tchaikovsky piano competition at the height of the Cold War, and was welcomed home with the ticker tape parade. His mother was his piano teacher, and when she was teaching him, she would say, "You know I'm not your mother now." Of his childhood, Cliburn said, "There were other things I would like to have done besides practicing the piano, but I knew my mother was right about what I should do." Cliburn lived with his mother all her life, but he largely forsook his career after the death of his father, who was also his manager, because he could not bear the pressure, and he suffered from depression and alcoholism, becoming a revered fixture of Fort Worth society, kind, affable, piously reactionary, and the figurehead of an eponymous competition that has become as prestigious as the one that he won. In 1945, there were 5 piano competitions worldwide. There are now 750. Robert Levin, professor of music at Harvard, said, "The favored repertoire is music of such technical challenges that as recently as 30 years ago, less than 1% of pianists were playing it. Now, about 80% are. It isn't an improvement. It reflects a purely gladiatorial physical behavior. You should not tell a young student to learn the notes and then add the expression. You might as well tell a chef, first you cook the food, then you add the flavor." Sue and Joe Peterson always put their son Drew's personal needs before his talent, but the two often seemed to coincide. Drew didn't speak until he was 3 and a half, but Sue never believed he was slow. When he was 18 months old, she was reading to him and skipped a word, whereupon Drew reached over and pointed to the missing word on the page. Drew didn't produce much sound at that stage, but he already cared about it deeply. Church bells would elicit a big response, Sue said. Birdsong would stop him in his tracks. Sue, who had learned piano as a child, taught Drew the basics on an old upright, and he became fascinated by sheet music. "He needed to decode it," Sue said, "so I had to recall what little I remembered, which was the treble clef." Drew said, "It was like learning 13 letters of the alphabet and then trying to read books." He figured out the bass clef on his own, and when he began formal lessons at 5, his teacher said he could skip the first 6 months' worth of material. Within the year, Drew was performing Beethoven sonatas at the recital hall at Carnegie Hall, and was flown to Italy to perform in a youth festival, where the other youths were a decade older than he. Sue said, "I thought it was delightful, but I also thought we shouldn't take it too seriously. He was just a little boy." The family had some differences with Drew's teacher, and Sue was advised to seek out a teacher named Miyako Lotto, who warned that she didn't have time to teach Drew, but would listen to him play and then refer him to someone else. When he finished playing, Lotto said, "I have time Tuesdays at 4. Years later, she recalled, "He could barely reach the pedals, but he played with every adult nuance you'd ever want. I thought, oh my God, this really is a genius. He's not mimicking and not being spoon-fed. His musicality comes from within." Her enthusiasm was not entirely welcome. Sue said, "It was so extreme, and it gave me the creeps." Joe said, "It just sounded ridiculous." Sue could not take Drew into Manhattan every week, but she enrolled him with a teacher in New Jersey whom Lotto recommended. Lotto emailed Sue every couple of weeks to ask how things were going. Every few months, she'd invite Drew to play for her. It felt very casual, but in retrospect, it was regimented and purposeful, Sue said. On his way to kindergarten one day, Drew asked his mother, "Can I just stay at home so I can learn something?" Sue was at a loss. "He was reading textbooks this big, and they're in class holding up a blow-up M," she said. Drew said, "At first it felt lonely. Then you accept that, yes, you're different from everyone else, but people will be your friends anyway." Drew's parents moved him to a Montessori school, then to a private school. They bought him a new piano because he had announced at 7 that their upright lacked dynamic contrast. "It cost more money than we'd ever paid for anything except a down payment on a house," Sue said. By junior high, he was performing frequently and had taken up competitive swimming with a team that practiced 9 hours a week. When Drew was 14, Sue found a homeschool program created by Harvard. "When I met Drew, he was 16 and halfway to a Harvard bachelor's degree." Spending time with the Petersons, I was struck not only by their mutual devotion, but also by the easy way they avoided the snobberies that tend to cling to classical music. Sue is a school nurse. Joe works in the engineering department of Volkswagen. They never expected the life into which Drew has led them, but they were neither intimidated by it nor brash in pursuing it. It remained both a diligence and an art. Joe said, "How do you describe a normal family? The only way I can describe a normal one is a happy one. What my kids do brings a lot of joy into this household." When I asked how Drew's talent had affected their parenting of his younger brother, Sue said, "It's distracting and different. It would be similar if Eric's brother had a disability or a wooden leg." The gravitational pull of music is inexorable for Drew. He said, "I thought at Harvard I would find some subjects that I was really interested in, maybe even more than music. I haven't, and I'm not sure I really want to." Since Lotto was at the Manhattan School of Music, Drew has pursued his musical education there. He said, "I don't want management and publicity now. I don't want a childhood in music. I want a life in music," Sue recalled. She had fielded invitations to put him on Oprah. "He was 7, Sue recalled, "and he said, 'I'm not a circus act.'" At 16, Drew still didn't want management. You have to be able to fight back, he explained. I asked Drew how he could express so much through music after so little life experience, and he said, I can only express it through music, not through words. Maybe I can only experience it through music, too. We assume that certain intimacies are apportioned to speech, others to sex, others to sports. But why shouldn't music be the locus of intimacy and speech the locus of formality? A year after I met him, Drew was selected for a master class with the Chinese pianist Lang Lang, then 28, and I went to watch them interact. Lang Lang, for whom speech is easy, coached 6 students. He said the least to Drew, and Drew the least to him. Yet Drew's playing changed to incorporate Lang Lang's insights with a fluency none of the others could muster. Sue said, his talent is a magnifying glass on what I need to do. To be honest, I have no way to know what I'm doing right or wrong, except to ask him. Drew said to her, you're always questioning. As much as I am a nonconformist, you're a questioner. She said, fortunately, your answers are very convincing. Musical talent can be divided into 3 components: the athletic, the mimetic, and the interpretive. It takes physical prowess to move your hands or lips with the precision most instruments require. To be a musician, the person has to have a mimetic capacity to reproduce others' techniques. That should not be dismissed as simply replication, said Justin Davidson, music critic for New York Magazine. That's how we learn to speak, to write, to express ourselves. Musicians who have a tremendous gift for mimicry can produce very refined interpretations at a very young age. Are they producing those because they've learned them from a teacher, from a recording, or from hearing other pianists, or because it comes to them internally? Everybody does both. Robert Levin said, it's hard to convey a message if you haven't learned how to pronounce the words. People who have amazing minds but neglect their technical skills will fail just as surely as people who are perfect at what they do but have no message. You have to take these apparently incompatible elements and make a vinaigrette of discipline and experience. As Pierre-Auguste Renoir said, craftsmanship has never stood in the way of genius. Musical performance, like sign, requires that manual dexterity become the seat of emotional and intellectual meaning. Sometimes that meaning is there from the beginning, as with Drew Peterson. Sometimes it comes later. The cellist and pedagogue Stephen Isserles complained to me that music is too often taught as a competitive sport. It should be taught like a mixture of religion and science, he said. Being able to move your fingers very fast is very impressive, but has nothing to do with music. Music does something to you. You don't do something to music. Mikhail and Natalie Peremsky held comfortable positions within the Soviet system. Mikhail with the Russian Atomic Agency, Natalie with the Physics Engineering Institute. Their daughter, Natasha, born in 1987, showed a precocious interest in the piano. Her younger brother, Misha, did not. I was in the kitchen and I thought, who is playing? Natalie recalled. Then I saw, it's the baby, picking out nursery songs. My husband said music was a terrible life. He begged me not to give her lessons. But Natalie thought a few lessons could do no harm. 6 months later, Natasha played a Chopin mazurka in a children's concert. She decided, I'm going to be a pianist at 4 years old, Natalie said. Natasha was always first in her class at school. We didn't worry about music because she was so good in math, physics, and chemistry. She could have easily done something else if she ran out of talent for this. When the Soviet